Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents We Will Not Go to Tuapse. From the Donets to the Oder with the Légion Wallonie and 5th SS Volunteer Assault Brigade, Wallonien, 1942-45. By Fernand Kaisergruber. Translated by Frederick P. Steinhardt, Ph.D. Edited by Kenneth W. Estes, Ph.D. Narrated by Paul Woodson. I have used the names of those whom I was able to contact and who gave me permission, as I have done with the names of those who are well enough known, and also the names of those who are dead. For the others, out of tact, I have only used initials. Author's Notes. I wrote this volume of recollections in a few months in 1991 without stopping while I was immersed in my past. Since then I reread several passages on a number of occasions in the hope of retrieving details that I no longer remembered. Even during the first rereading I asked myself if it would be good to rewrite it, to put it in a little more classic style, for I recognized a certain lack of classicism on my part in its composition. The truth is that I committed to paper all of the memories that returned to me in a flood, in the spirit, and as they came to me. After my last re-reading, I told myself that it would be better to change nothing, because the first draft was what came to me naturally, and I think that it is better thus. I hope that the readers will agree. Translator's Notes. I kept this author's note in mind as I translated. At first I was tempted to render his account into smooth-flowing English with perfect syntax and grammar, but it lost too much of the freshness and vivacity. After all, a translator is rather like an actor. His job is to get inside the author, as an actor gets inside his character. When I started the translating, I was still thinking of the work I usually do, where my job is to translate military history, usually written by military professionals, into professional military language for other military professionals to read. Before I read Fernand's note that he wanted inserted, I started doing that, and it just did not feel right. Then I read his note and realized what he was saying. I remembered that translating, as I understand it, is not just rendering equivalent words in perfect grammar and syntax, but getting inside the author's head, or rather letting him get inside mine, so that he can use me to express his thoughts, his feelings, in his words, but in another language. So, if there are incomplete sentences, and at times it is almost stream of consciousness, that is the nature of this young man's account, and that is the captivating beauty and intensity that inspires it. The choice of words also required careful thought, for in the original French, the author does not always employ the usual words, and sometimes his language is fanciful, different, with a hint of the romance of youth. The author delights in plays on words. Where possible, I tried to carry that over to the English. There were, however, a few instances where that was impossible. In some cases it would have made no sense at all, so I had to drop the wordplay in the translation. Ranks in La Légion Wallonienne are Belgian army ranks, hence commandeur, capitaine, lieutenant, adjutant, warrant officer, sergent, etc., rather than German ranks such as commandant, hauptmann, leutnant, feldwebel, unteroffizier, etc. Editor's Notes. I first met Fernand Kaisergruber in June of 1982, while researching my doctoral dissertation on the Western European volunteers in the German Army and Waffen-SS. We had corresponded briefly before my trip to Europe, and without hesitation he opened his home to me on two separate occasions, and made introductions to facilitate interviews with some of the volunteers. He has, since then, assisted a host of scholars and writers and given film and video interviews on several occasions to recount his experiences, and above all to enhance the understanding of himself and his cohorts during World War II. It has been my privilege to participate in this publication of his chronicle for the first time in English. The unique ending of World War II influenced greatly its aftermath, as well as our remembrance of many related factors. Today, with the collapse of the USSR and the end of the division of Europe between East and West on ideological, economic, and military lines, the ongoing post-war history now has to be rethought. This also means that the recovery of memory can take place. Already underway in the 1960s, the younger generations have asked not only about the war, but also what happened after the war. What was the Holocaust about? What was collaboration? Who participated? The same for the resistance. Then there is the question of justice and how it has operated since liberation and war's end. These and more debates began in earnest in post-1989 Europe. Who did what to whom, and with whose help, served as a valid question not only for the war but also its aftermath, extending well into the 1950s. We now must consider matters of political justice, collective memory, the differences between resistance and collaboration, and the long-term social and political consequences of the war. No clear lines existed between collaboration and resistance, and various shades of gray remained. Although collaboration's usage today owes from this period, some other terms become more useful in explaining the experiences of the occupied countries. Cooperation, collusion, compliance, and complicity, if we just stick to the C range. The punishments doled out to those found guilty also varied, from lynchings committed during the last months of the war to post-war sentences of death, imprisonment, or hard labor. In addition, there were penalties of national disgrace, loss of civil rights, government employment, pensions, and the imposition of travel restrictions, fines, and other administrative strictures. Not only a wide array of individuals received punishment, but also groups were held collectively responsible for what had taken place. Some ethnic groups were charged with crimes and treason and largely killed or expelled in the months immediately after the German surrender. Then there are the military tribunals held post-war, where the accused had to prove their innocence instead of the court proving their guilt. These purges and expulsions came in the aftermath of over 5 years of wartime mass movements and exterminations of other ethnic minorities. How the surviving societies processed the occupation and the return of the pre-war governments reflected various shocks with an acceleration of social changes wrought by the war and by pre-war conditions. Numerous states had experienced social upheaval before the war. Then came the war and either alliances with the major warring powers, occupation, or armed neutrality. Some countries were dismembered in the process. Others expanded their territories. By using middle terms between collaboration and resistance, we can deal retroactively with the experience of war and occupation in Europe. The previous measure of post-war judicial actions we must recast as political justice. The resulting narratives of wartime stress and destruction were used post-war to justify the post-war states, as if those problems taking place before the war no longer existed. We can now see the 1989 collapse of Europe's walls, and in the aftermath, the USSR itself can only be explained if we remember pre-war, wartime, and post-war periods as a continuing process, a struggle toward an end not yet defined for us in 2015. Kenneth W. Estes. Preface. I am not writing my memoirs. I consider that word to be pompous. After those of Chateaubriand, Beaumarchais, and others, I would feel quite ridiculous. I might more modestly speak of chronicles, but there too more illustrious personages have preceded me. Rather, I shall relate my memories simply and without the least literary pretension, without embellishment, adding nothing but concealing nothing. It is not in my nature, and it would be totally ridiculous to lay it on, having lived all those years through events of such dramatic or exalting intensity, sometimes both at the same time. I believe that I lived intensely, as if each day was to be my last, and I think that it was very good to have done so. In any case, I've always been at the very limit of what seemed important to me in the end. Several times I told myself that one day I would recount the most interesting years of my life, in any case the most captivating for me of the years one cannot forget. How could we? Of the years of which, above all, I have no regrets. How could I? Neither the years of the war, nor the 5 years of imprisonment in the penal colonies and concentration camps in Belgium have beaten me down, no more than they have broken the majority of us. God knows, however, what the conditions were at times, and the crowding of those years of the penal colonies. For me, all of that was subject to reflection and a lesson of experience. But the fruits of this lesson certainly have no resemblance to those imagined by the authorities of the time, judicial and otherwise, who were responsible for our convictions. A few months of detention, a year, or possibly two, would have largely sufficed for my experience, but too bad. It is the past, neither regrets nor bitterness. Not that, you may believe me, I have been able to accept the legitimacy of this conviction, based, and do not forget this, upon retroactive laws, thus a denial of justice, pure and simple, but quite simply because it has then given me the strength to overcome all the pitfalls that life spread in my path, or yet more traps that these same authorities set for us after our liberation, such as after having served our prison terms, preventing us from being able to find work, and thereby forcing us to become criminals. And yet, I have never known of any of us being later condemned as a common criminal. It is worth remembering that there never was such an example, or in any case very few, for the press would not have missed the opportunity to make much of such a case. But I shall talk of all this later. Unconsciously, I saved all the notes that I made right after the events, with the intention of one day telling the story. Obviously, those concerning the last months of the war were lost in the torment of those final days, and when I was arrested. 5 years of imprisonment provided me with sufficient leisure to recreate these notes to a large degree, and I had around me a number of my comrades who were able to help me when my memory of dates or of certain locations was less than exact. Moreover, during my imprisonment in the different jails of the realm, I was able to see again most of the survivors of our common epic. I finally made the decision to write because Roland D. asked me to relate the circumstances of the period of instruction in 1942. He then requested that I relate my memories of the other events of those years, and thus it is entirely logical that I maintained the momentum. The reader must excuse a certain lack of uniformity between this period of instruction and what ensues, but I have preferred to change nothing, or very little, in this initial part of my life in the Légion, for fear of altering the first impression. I must speak briefly of the last years before the war to make clear the course of my thoughts and the decisions that my reasoning led me, in all logic, to take. I was never a timid soul, and am no more so 75 years later. As I start this narrative, I tell myself that one day in the future my children, perhaps other people too, a little more concerned with informing themselves than the others, may find something of interest here, and will better understand the whys and the hows. Bitterness? It is true that I have at times encountered it, but I have not succumbed to it, and it will never overwhelm me. It is what I decided a long time ago, back when I could only see the sky through the bars of my various jails. I have acquired this equanimity, not without difficulty, at the cost of effort, of blood, and above all through the will to surmount all, for at the risk of insanity, of self-destruction, there was no other choice. You must remember that we emerged from 5 years of war, 3.5 of which, and more than 4 years for some of our comrades who survived, were under arms, and we then passed without transition from these last and extremely trying months at the front to the shadow of years in prisons, and we were only 20 years old. This is not an outcry, let alone a complaint. Others have suffered, I know, but the fact that we were vanquished does not necessarily make us wrong. It was necessary at any price to shut us up and to hide the truth to the end of time. The German breakthrough was led by the SS Viking Division and the Brigade Motorisée Wallonie. The Walloons fought fiercely alongside the SS of the Viking Division, doing everything to prove themselves worthy of the uniform they wore. This appreciation is taken from the work L'URSS dans la Seconde Guerre Mondiale, the USSR and the Second World War, published in 5 volumes in French, in Volume 4, describing the Battle of Korsun-Cherkassy. It was one of the units encircled at Cherkassy in January 1944, and in February played a major part in the successful breakout. The brigade was given the task of holding the escape corridor open, which it performed with considerable distinction, although suffering appalling casualties in the process. It is believed that the brigade was reduced from 2,000 to 632 men in this action. The Walloon volunteers earned a very high fighting reputation during their service with the German Army and Waffen-SS. This other opinion, or judgment, is taken from The Waffen-SS by Martin Windrow, Oxford, 1992. These eulogies, which we have never sought nor solicited, allow us to freely ignore the opinions or commentaries of a certain number of our own country's historians. There are also honest men to be found here, but the media have an irritating tendency to avoid or ignore them. Forward. At least the girls were beautiful. For F. Kaisergruber and his comrades, I was at that time a terrorist. To the La Legia newspaper, I was a bandit. I have always been proud of that. If in 1943 or 1944, before December, my commander had ordered me to knock off Kaisergruber, I would have done it without moodiness, without haste, with no pangs of conscience, without remorse. Befehl, an order, was always befehl on all sides. All too often that is forgotten. My conception of life, my political or philosophical ideas, such as I took the time or trouble to have, were often the opposite of the author's. Always resisting in my soul, I nevertheless read this book and agreed to write these lines, not out of admiration for the author, nor for his Bourguignons, Burgundians, nor for their chansons de geste, but out of curiosity about our past history, and out of respect for all that is human. The considerations, the digressions, the inopportune positions taken by F. Kaisergruber frequently irritated me. His blind and naive admiration for everything German, his suspicion, his contempt, his sarcasm toward the things and the beings that are precious to me, have often tempted me to open a second front with the pen. I regret that his memory is more alert to the mistakes of the Allies than for those of the others, but I applaud his enthusiasm, his loyalty to his pledged word and to his comrades. When, in the depths of his narrative, he sings of the heroism, the suffering, and the battles of the Bourguignons of La Légion Wallonne, I often say, "That's fine for you. You only had to fuck around in that shit." His book has aroused in me sympathy for the Russians that I had never possessed before reading this. I have now known F. Kaisergruber for years as an upright man, honest, decent, cultivated, and I discover his attractive personality in his book as simple, honest, and straightforward. He bears witness for his friends and for the others, the sincere opponents of long ago to a certain mentality, a very genuine ideal, romanticism, a camaraderie that is often unknown, despised or unrecognized, but moving beyond compare. A devoted Flamand, ever devoted to an unforgettable Belgian resistance in Wallonia, I feel that now that the war is over, the combatants of all sides, especially those that have truly known the fire, the hand-to-hand fighting, the fear and the death, those who did not await the evolution of events to enlist in one or the other camp, those that risked all, ought to get together if only to be able to hear, to understand, and to understand beyond the dissension, the quarrels, the hostilities of half a century ago. This book by F. Kaisergruber is valuable because, without embellishments, it invites the entire world to examine its conscience, because he recounts events that are inadequately known or entirely unknown, that are too quickly forgotten or hastily hidden, because it is yet one more proof that all the flags, all the soldiers, and all the ideals are worthy of the highest respect, for young men have fallen under all the flags and for all the ideals, each of them dreaming on their side of a better world and a more beautiful future. This book proves that if, to our eyes, the légionnaires of the East were wrong, they were not therefore traitors, and that in every way they had the courage to live and to risk their lives for their ideals. I believe that though they were adversaries, they were not enemies. I believe that true democracy need not fear the ideas, the beliefs, the dreams, the regrets, or the nostalgia of the veterans. All that belongs, like us, to history. My companions fell, and we were beaten, for liberty and freedom, wherever it comes from. Faithful to this ideal, I believe that F. Kaiser Gruber also has the liberty to speak and to write, that his book has the right to exist, and that it is of interest as a credo that is at times moving, and also pertinent, insolent, and impertinent, as a witness that is certainly extremely personal and subjective, but vibrant with the ideals, the loves, the combats, the adventures, the suffering, the disillusionment, the hopes and despair of our generation that were in their 20s during the 40s. I love to read that for the Bourguignons, les autres, the others, and for us, the terroristes, that the girls everywhere were pretty and desirable, and that with or without uniform, black or white, we have all at least approached a subject with the same eyes and the same ideas, the girls of our youth and the courage of our mothers. As a believer, I believe that we must reconcile with our brothers before leaving for the house of our Father. The Christ did not say that we must make exceptions for the brothers of the left or of the right. Gott mit uns is well over with. God does not allow himself to be wrapped in a uniform, even if one calls him Allah. And as I have already had the pleasure to say before the cameras, as a believer or not, it is time for our generation to understand that the hour of departure, not to arms but from life, is approaching, and that it is still laughable, even more than it is futile, to arrive on the other side with our flags and our submachine guns. Louis de Lentdecker, former editor of De Standard, Het Nieuwsblad, former président de la presse bruxelloise, member of the Armée Secrète Croix de Guerre avec Palme, for acts of courage under fire before the enemy. Unabridged text, August 5, 1991. 1. From Peace to War. My early childhood and my youth were happy and carefree, even privileged. There was nothing to excite me to go and see something different. I had no extenuating circumstances, as the military interrogators delight to say, nor have I ever claimed such. What I have laid claim to, precisely and jealously, is complete responsibility for my commitment. Even if the environment in which I lived could undoubtedly explain the course of this evolution, I would disavow that, or at least a good part of it, since even though the choices of my older brothers were similar to mine, my parents and my sister did not espouse them at all. Ever since I was 13 or 14, my friends were mostly older than myself. I hung out with my brother's friends and embraced the politics of one of them. I did not miss a political gathering, whether it was at the local Rex in the Rue Mercelis, at the Zonica on the Move, in the Chaussée de Wavre at Odergame, or at the Sports Palace. I was at Lombec Sainte-Marie and also at Place Caim at Vatermel to receive the defrocked Abbé Moreau. The soirées, the weekends were well attended. My youthful age did not prevent me from recognizing connections between the conduct of certain authorities, notably religious. This developed according to circumstances, and more precisely, regarding the conduct of our parish priest, for whom, despite everything, I had a certain respect, at least until the day when I was able to confirm, with a certain irony, his incoherence, his duplicity. We lived 200 to 300 meters from a workers' housing estate, a staunchly red housing estate, where JGS, Jeune Garde Socialiste, Socialist Young Guards, and Faucon Rouge, Red Falcon Youth Movement, were more numerous than the good parishioners. That is self-evident, and the Catholic Scouts, which I belonged to until the day when, very paradoxically, they decided that I had ideas that were, on the whole, not at all orthodox. Due to proximity and the force of circumstances, I also had friends among the Reds. How could it have been otherwise? The more so since I did not have the same prejudices as certain priests and other adults. I did indeed say certain, but in all truth a large number, and among these Reds there were certainly men of good faith, honest men, as one puts it, very good fellows. But our parish priest had an entirely different opinion. He believed that there were respectable people, and that there were others who were not at all so. Thus, one good day he went to find my father, to tell him that one had seen me talking or playing with those people. No less than that. My father, who was nevertheless very close to the parish priest when he was a member and even president of different congregations and other parish associations, replied very politely and also diplomatically that I was, doubtless, in the process of developing my judgment and also my perspective. When the parish priest, with such good intentions, then departed, my father nevertheless advised me to keep an eye on my relationships and to sort them out if necessary. When, a little later, the 1937 elections began, where Léon de Grelle was face to face with Van Zeeland, and the right-thinking people were, little by little, separated from me, I asked myself under what influences, for I could not imagine that it was due to the advice of our parish priest. I asked myself if I had not dreamed all this, for from the first collections of election posters that I saw, and all the world could see them, this Catholic right-thinking youth was now united as a good family ought to be with all those that I had been exhorted to shun, denying me even the right to talk to them. Translator's Note: Liberals, Socialists, and Catholics united for Van Zeeland as a coalition candidate against de Grelle. Together they put up posters vaunting the merits and fundamental honesty of Van Zeeland. They drank the glass of friendship in the local bistros and quickly united to beat us in an apparently pre-ecumenical spirit, against which we had not the slightest ally. If I had been as naive as our parish priest thought, I would have been quite astonished. But I was not so at all, alas. On the contrary, it caused me to reflect on the constancy and inconstancy of the moral authorities. During the Van Zeeland scandal, I remember approaching Van Zeeland, along with some of my comrades, as he was leaving the church in the quarter, and shouting, "We want Rex! The Van Zeeland scandal!" while thrusting the newspaper at him. I also remember a long wait at the top of a tall telephone pylon of the sort that existed at that time. It was on the Boulevard de Souverain, at the foot of l'Avenue Chaudron, at the moment of the elections. We had stretched a big white sheet with one or another electoral slogan on it around the crown of the pylon. When we were going to descend, two policemen, holding their bicycles with their hands, passed and stopped at the foot of our high perch. We thought that they had seen us and were waiting for us. In actual fact, it was not that at all, but pure chance. They chatted away for nearly an hour. All the same, we remained stuck up there, exposed to the four winds, waiting until they left. The soirées at the local Rex meeting room on the Rue de Chartreux did not lack for animation, or, at times, anxious waiting, when we hoped for the miracle to finance the publication of the next day's paper. The euphoria of the elections of 1936, the consternation after those of 1937, but never discouragement. I don't believe that I have ever seen such political fervor, met such fervid devotion, later in any other party. It was often very late when we returned in the evening, after the meetings or after we had put up the election posters, and it was rare that we returned alone. We then made chips or crepes and ate in gay company until late in the night, while my parents slept upstairs, or at least gave the impression of so doing. The crazy ambiance of these meetings thus continued in a small group of friends. It is necessary to have known this fervent and dynamic atmosphere to better understand the later repercussions. There was the war in Spain, and the prayers for Franco. There was the campaign in Abyssinia. I felt more sympathy for the Duce than for the Caudillo. Thus we passed through all these political developments to arrive at the International Munich Accords, the German-Soviet Pact,
the Anschluss, and the phony war to the actual war. My brothers were mobilized, one stationed at the Albert Canal, the other in the Haute Fagne. On the evening of May 9, 1940, I go to bed as usual, without any apprehension of...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?